Members, the hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order Higher Education Finance and Policy. The rules of this committee are going to be defined operatively during the course of the hearings. The first rule is we start on time. The agenda is going to change a little bit. We have a number of illnesses. House research is out with the cold and flu. We have at least two members who are in a similar condition. So the part on the regents and the overview of the legal obligations will wait till Wednesday. With that, the next item on the agenda is the University of Minnesota. So whoever is presenting for the U, come on up and please identify yourself for the record. Members, I would encourage you to ask questions as we proceed. I would also like to just warn everyone, we are having no hearings on either the governor's budget or the U's proposed budget or the Minsky's proposed budget until we are done with these hearings. So I understand the University of Minnesota has already launched an email onslaught to members. That is premature, and it's premature on several levels. In order to do the governor's budget, significant amounts of revenue have to be passed. So let's not count our budgets till the revenue is hatched. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Fitzenreiter. I go by Fitz for short. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota, a former House staff employee back from 82 to 92. And I have with me, I'll just let them introduce themselves, a couple of colleagues that will be helping me out as we make this presentation today.
Chairman, members, Lincoln Carlson, Director of Financial Research.
Could you say that again and pull the mic over, please?
Sorry, certainly. Lincoln Carlson, Director.
Spell it.
K-A-L-L-S-E-N, Director of Financial Research at the University of Minnesota.
And good afternoon. I'm Julie Tonneson, and I am the Associate Vice President for Budget and Finance and the Budget Director for the University.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do want to acknowledge three regents and one former regent here, former Regent Huntley. But Regent Cohen, Beeson, and Vine are here with us today. So if you have any other questions for them, I know they'd be anxious to comment.
And members, just again, we're going to do an overview by House Research of the regent selection process, probably on Wednesday. Mr. Gehring is ill, and he cannot attend this meeting. And we welcome anyone that you wish to come down to assist you. That's perfectly acceptable.
Mr. Chairman, members, as we proceed through this presentation today, I think the understanding is that if folks have questions along the way, simply interrupt us. We have today's meeting and Wednesday's meeting scheduled, and I don't think we'll get through the entire presentation today. But we're happy to come as often as you'd like to talk about the University of Minnesota. I do bring you greetings from President Kaler. I did see him this morning. His arm was in a little bit of a sling. He broke up a fight between his dogs yesterday and ended up with some stitches. So I'm sure you'll see him in the coming days with a bandage on his arm there. I do want to... before we launch into it, read you a little bit of some minutes from a Board of Regents meeting. And just to set the stage here, those minutes read, further economies may be difficult, for with an increase in the student body of over 60% in the last 10 years and an increase of only 9% in state appropriations, there's not a great leeway for trimming. Let me continue. It should be understood that these cuts and postponements in services and normal repairs and replacements now being undertaken, however much they may limit the university's usefulness, are considered by the Board of Regents as wise precautions. These minutes go on to say that these methods of curtailment and retrenchment are suggested, and they give some examples. No automatic or other salary increases should be recommended, except for some unusual emergency positions becoming vacant should, so far as possible, be left vacant. Promotions to vacant positions should be recommended only under the most exceptional circumstances, and the minutes go on and on. These minutes are from the Board of Regents meeting in 1932. Sounds familiar today, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, maybe the Regents would like to have a copy of that.
Madam Chair, I obtained it from the Regents' office.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, and I repeat, given my understanding with Region candidates and current Regents, I think you'd better give them each one by hand.
I'll do that, Mr. Chairman. The agenda today for this presentation is to give you an overview of the University of Minnesota, really primarily from a financial point of view. We will talk about the university's operating budget process, how we develop the biennial budget, the annual budget process inside the university. We will talk about our revenues and expenditures. We're going to delve into a cost definition and benchmarking exercise that the university completed during the past year. And in that particular part of our presentation, we will talk about the Wall Street Journal article. I know that's on folks' mind, and we have some further clarification information about that. We'll talk about capital projects and university debt service, and we will talk about unexpended funds at the end of the year, their importance in our terms of our debt capacity and our liquidity. And we did receive, as committee members know, a list of questions from Chairman Pawlowski, and throughout the presentation, we will be providing specific answers to many of those questions. Again, if there are questions along the way, please feel free to interrupt us. this slide here, and I believe you have it in your packet, just gives you a sort of 60,000 foot view of the university. We do have 68,000 students, 5 campuses, 21 research and outreach centers, 16 regional extension offices, 6 area health education and regional, or health education center regional offices. A little bit more background here. We manage approximately 28 million square feet of space in 863 buildings system-wide. We manage 27,000 acres of land. We have 1.4 million square feet of classrooms, 2.2 million square feet of research space and labs, 10 galleries and museums, 14 libraries with 7 million volumes, 25,000 headcount employees, and we issue 36,000 paychecks per 2-week pay period. We issue about 15,000 degrees a year. We track $750 million with the federal research funds annually. We track and bill about $1 billion of student tuition and fees. We process $490 million annually of federal financial aid. We process roughly 2 million student registrations for classes annually. We review about 114,000 applications and process 80,000 transcript requests per year. We also process about 4.5 million yearly financial transactions inside the university, completing about 150,000 purchase orders a year just for supplies and services. We do about a little over 100,000 unique financial reports to operating units at the university every month of the year. And we manage about $3.6 billion in short and long-term investments. I'd like to turn to my colleague Lincoln Carlson to take you through some more detail of student data and financial aid, and then we'll be back with some other. We'll be trading off during the remainder of the presentation.
Mr. Collins.
Mr. Chairman, okay. Thank you, members. Just a few high-level figures to get us oriented. Before you is the fall 2012 student headcount system-wide for the University of Minnesota, over 68,000 students. This is up almost 2,700 students over 2006, and including over 3,400 additional undergraduate students over that time. I'd also note that the 18,055 graduate professional students is one of the largest graduate professional programs of its kind in the country. One question before us was a question about the number of students per faculty member and how that's changed since 2006. Before you, you'll see that that ratio has increased 8.3% over this time period from 26.5 students per faculty member to 28.7. That included a 4.5% increase in enrollment over that time period and a 3% decrease in tenure track faculty.
Excuse me, I think Representative Winkler, did you have a question? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question on the previous slide. Just a question about what are non-degree students?
Mr. Collinson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Non-degree students can be a variety of types of students. So we have a College of Continuing Education, for example, that enrolls on the Twin Cities campus, where community members can come and take a variety of classes, both credit-bearing and non-credit-bearing. On all of our campuses, we do allow people from the community, when there is space available in courses, to come and avail themselves of those courses. And so it's a wide variety of folks. In Crookston, I'd also note that they have a very robust college and schools program, and so you're seeing some of those numbers in the Crookston number.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, specifically in Crookston, college and schools, are you talking about concurrent enrollment type courses, and are you counting those students as non-degree, or what is college and the schools?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Collison.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, college and schools is a program that has our faculty working with high school teachers collaboratively to provide courses that in some cases can be award college credit, and other cases are merely more college preparatory in nature. So they are students that are generally not yet enrolled. In fact, they are not yet enrolled in a degree-seeking program at the University of Minnesota, but can take these courses in their high schools in collaboration with university faculty, often for college credit.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know in the future you're going to talk about the application to enrollment numbers, but I'm curious about the capacity. So in that slide, as far as what you would expect, as have you reached the capacity in each of the areas, Twin Cities on down to Crookston? Thanks.
Mr. Calls.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe we would say that certainly on the Twin Cities campus, and I'll talk about this in a second, but we have again increased our freshman enrollment targets in specific colleges. But in general, I believe Vice Provost McMaster, who's here, can speak to this more forcefully if you'd like. But I believe on the Twin Cities campus, we're very comfortable with where the freshman numbers are at. Morris, Crookston, and Duluth, I would say, still have modest capacity remaining at the freshman level, though I would note that certainly at Crookston and Duluth, and more recently in Morris, not only are there faculty student ratio numbers, but there's also housing considerations on those campuses. We've aggressively added residence halls in Crookston. We have one being constructed right now in Morris. So those are limiting factors as well.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you consider capacity, what are all the factors that you consider?
Mr. Collison.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would say that there's always several factors. One of which, of course, is not only student-faculty ratios, housing capacity. There is certainly there's always a look at how the students distribute themselves. So what do I mean by that? As you might imagine, we have different demand curves for different programs. Carleton School of Management, College of Biological Sciences, increasingly College of Science and Engineering, are increasingly competitive programs. We are we are managing that demand at different levels as the students express varied interest in our programs.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you. I think there's a it's a bucket of worms here that we're going into, and I won't go further, but I think there's a lot of questions regarding that. Thank you.
Representative Poppy, it's likely to be a rather large bucket before we're done, so just keep delving in. There is a bottom somewhere. Proceed.
Next slide is a look at freshman applications, offers, and enrollees at on the Twin Cities campus. And you'll note that that application curve, while dropping in 2012 just slightly, I would say for this fall we are up over 40,000 applications for the first time. Our offers have continued to go up. Our yield rate, we are attracting a more academically competitive body. And in terms of number of enrollees, you can see our freshman enrollments have increased on the Twin Cities campus. We've lately strategically increased both the freshman enrollment targets in College of Biological Sciences and the College of Science and Engineering.
Mr. Carlson, that drop in enrollment, is it coincidental that the U proposes a zero increase in tuition while you're having a drop in enrollment, and you may be seeing future drops in enrollment, and therefore you're trying to stabilize your tuition in order to maintain the number of students?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the top line is an application number and is again up this fall, so that the number you see there is fall 2012. I'm sorry, fiscal year 2012, fall 11. Fall 12, this fall, we're up over 40,000. So we're back up.
So you're not seeing any decline that would be commensurate with proposing a zero tuition increase?
Mr. Chairman, members, not at the undergraduate level. We have had a very slight decrease at the graduate level.
All right.
And this next slide is a slide on Twin Cities retention and graduation rates by entry year. So the top line represents first year retention rates. And you can see on the grid at the bottom the goals that the Board of Regents have set for university administration in all of these areas. So the top line is first year retention rate, and then our 4, 5, and 6 year graduation rates. For the Twin Cities campus. All of our campuses have similar goals and charts that we can talk about if you'd like. I would just note that this past year we've exceeded our first year retention goal for the first time ever, 91%. That's competitive with any school in the Big Ten.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, what happens if they don't attain these goals? They've set them, so what happens if they don't? What's the consequence? Except that they will have fewer students, I can see that, but what happens if they don't?
Mr. Chairman, members, I assume your question is if the students don't?
No, I'm saying these are set by the campuses, correct? By the system?
Yes.
So if the system doesn't maintain that or doesn't achieve the goal, what's the consequence of not achieving the goal?
Well,
aside from the fact that it's good PR to have them, what's the other consequence, if there is one?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, certainly in spots where we see graduation rates, if in fact they, or retention rates, fell, the Provost, Karen Hansen, would be in dialogue with the dean and department chairs to understand what actions can be taken, what's causing any drop in graduation rates, and they would address it through those academic programs.
Mr. Fitzgerald, would you have any examples of that you could show us? Not today, I understand, but would there be any examples of that?
Mr. Chairman, we'll be happy to I'll look into that and bring some information on Wednesday, if in fact it has happened in particular programs.
All right. My observation is that higher ed is great at setting its own goals and then in always meeting them. So I would hope that this isn't just an artificial goal, that it's a purpose, and behind that purpose would be, if they weren't met, there would be a consequence.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Board of Regents, the President, and the chief academic leaders of the institution take these goals very seriously, and as you can see, the trajectory and the effort behind this to raise those goals, and when we need a goal, we will set another goal to be met. This is a very important metric for the university.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we'd like to shift here to talk about the university's operating budget process. These are, again, questions that were posed in your letter to us. How do we go about developing our biennial request and our annual operating budget? And I'm going to turn to my colleague, Julie Tennyson, to take us through this part of the presentation.
Ms. Tennyson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. So we're going to talk about, just briefly, the biennial budget request process. It is one of the two operating budget processes we operate within the university, and then we'll spend a little bit more time on the annual budget process internally, delivering a recommended budget to the board every year for approval. So the biennial budget process within the university starts similarly to state agencies in the summer of every even-numbered year. We begin the process by talking about really a 30,000-foot look at the university's budget framework. We look at what are the major costs we know we're going to face the next 2 years, what are some of the known costs, things like utilities and debt service and so forth, and fringe benefit costs, what are some of the investments we might want to make over the next couple of years. We look at other revenues, what might happen with some of those. We look at tuition, where has it been recently, what's the trend been, what's the impact on students and so forth. And then we talk about what kind of partnership we want to make with the state and in what areas. And that is really how we develop the biennial budget request. It starts at a very high level, but again, we're looking at the university's overall budget, not just that one state appropriation number when we put this together. And we'll get more into that here in a few minutes. We comply with the instructions from MMB every year, just like a state agency does, and we submit a budget request after it is reviewed and approved by our Board of Regents. We submit it in October, and it goes through the process, as you are aware, just like the state agencies, through really the legislative session and into May. For this particular series right now we're in, so we were looking at FY14 and FY15 and projecting costs for the University of Minnesota during that time, costs and revenues, and built the budget request to fit and address those challenges and needs. We, as the chair mentioned earlier, we're not here to talk today about our specific requests. This is just the process piece of it, okay, developing it. We will be back later to talk about the requests for 14 and 15.
So, Ms. Tennyson,
yep.
Explain to me what happens on the Duluth campus or the Crookston campus or the Morris campus when you go into this process.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the campuses are treated equally in the process in that the chancellors are a part of strategy sessions with the president, just like the vice presidents or the deans would be on the Twin Cities campus. They are treated much like a college would be in terms of the process and their involvement in the input they get throughout the development of these requests. It is ultimately the president's request and submittal to the board, but he puts it together with the input of people across the campuses.
Ms. Townsend, where does the chancellor get their information? The Duluth chancellor, for instance, where does that individual get their information? How is that acquired?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Information on...
Well, here's my more detailed question.
Sure.
What constituency groups on those campuses are involved with putting those budgets together? For instance, faculty, for instance, the unions, any other groups that are... putting together the budget on each campus so that there is a budget per campus. And I ask the question because in the meetings that I've had so far with representatives, the answer I always get is they have no input. It's all done up here, and it's presented going this way. So that's why I did say a detail. I'd like to know how they put those budgets together at the campus level, both the operational budget and the capital budget.
Mr. Chairman, members of the
committee, Mr. Fitzenreiter,
we were in this particular instance just discussing how the biennial budget proposal is put together. In a moment, we'll talk about the annual budget process, but I do want to comment about the process a little bit more on the biennial in the context of the chairman's specific question. You know, I've been at the university since 92, just a little over 20 years, and I've seen the biennial budget process development in many different forms. Sometimes it is built more from the bottom up at the institution, and sometimes presidents have said, no, these are the priorities I want in the biennial request. I don't want to have a lengthy and laborious process of building from the bottom. But on some occasions, we have built from the bottom. President Kaler in the biennial budget he'll present this session really built that and started it last summer at the president's retreat, in which chancellors, academic leaders, operational staff were all involved at that retreat, where a discussion of the priorities and the needs of the university sort of emanated out of that initial discussions at retreat. So on the biennial request, we have a more deliberate and inclusive process in the annual budget process that we'll get to next.
All right. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Ms. Tonnison. Is it Tonnison?
Tonnison.
I'll get it eventually, okay? You know, one of the things as a layperson that I like to see is historical data and comparative data. And I found that when I have that information, even an average person and a citizen in the community can understand what's going on from a financial standpoint. What I mean is, if you look at that slide, students per tenure track faculty system wide, and there's been a gradual increase on that according to the information you gave us, and that's fine from a historical standpoint. I really appreciate that. But the other thing I find is comparative data, like other Big Ten schools or similar type schools to the University of Minnesota, how are they comparing in relationship to those figures? And that's just one example. And I don't want to overburden you either, but that information has to be available somewhere on the internet or for certain individuals. I doubt if it's available for the public in general, where you can compare the those types of figures on a comparative basis. So historical and comparative, that really helps me to understand and to ask questions and down the road. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Representative Gruning, do you want a response, or would you like her to?
Yeah. Yeah,
Ms. Tonnison, go ahead.
Quickly, you will see in this presentation today some of that. We agree in many cases that comparative data is valuable, and we have inserted that in different places, not in every slide, but we also can get information along those lines if it's requested. So, yes. Okay, so I'm going to move now to talk about the annual budget process.
Excuse me, Representative Rosenthal, would like to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who to address this with. Is this slide 5, where the 5 and 6 year graduation rates are so much higher than the 4 year? Does that have anything to do with tuition and students needing to work to go to school, or what? How do you explain that?
Mr. Carlson, do you want to handle that one, or who?
Mr. Chairman, members, is this the yes. Slide of question? And I'm sorry, could you...
Representative Rosenthal, he might want to pull the mic just a little closer.
I'm just interested in the gap between 5 and 6 year graduates and 4 year graduates. And I was wondering if tuition had a role in that and they were going out and working. Hmm. And how do you explain it?
Mr. Carlson, or whoever you want to have.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Reasons for the graduation rates that we have are a very complex question that have a lot to do with things that you mentioned, student working, parent contribution, level of debt, And it's a whole topic in and of itself that we'd be happy. I think HESO is going to come and address the committee about student debt. But we'd be happy to come and have an extensive dialogue about that. It's just a really complex issue that needs a lot of talk and understanding that might, and we didn't come prepared today to specifically answer that question, but we can.
Members, the office...
Mr. Chairman, we do have someone who could add a little, shed a little light on it for you today.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Robert McMaster, and I'm the Vice Provost and Dean of Undergraduate Education on the Twin Cities campus. The answer is actually pretty simple. It's a cumulative number. So you take the number who graduate in 4 years, that's 58%. How many students then graduate in 5 years, that's 71%, because you have 13% more. And then how many graduate in 6 years, that's 73%, and that's 2% more. So the number accumulates through time and would get larger every year as you capture more and more of those students.
Representative Rosenthal.
So you don't think there's any correlation to tuition and the rates?
Mr. McMaster?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't think tuition would play into that. What plays into that is student performance, academic advising, whether the student stops out for a period of time. The tuition rates are constant even into the fifth and sixth year. Now, a student may feel if they've accumulated a bit more debt that they need to stop out in the third year or fourth year, and that might push them into the fifth or sixth year, if that gets at your question.
That's exactly my question.
Members, the Office of Higher Education is going to prepare a much more detailed study of student debt. You saw the article that came out in October of 2012. That had the privates, it had the University of Minnesota, it had Minsky. Their report will also include the for-profits, and it's going to be much more detailed than the report that came out in October 2012. So Mr. Fitzenreiter is correct. We're going to let the Office of Higher Ed present that, and that's going to be at the end of the University of Minnesota and Minsky hearings. But we're very concerned with that question of how that debt skyrocketed over the last decade. Go ahead. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just had a follow-up how the Twin Cities campus graduation rates compared to the greater Minnesota campuses.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first-year retention rates on the system campuses in Duluth, Duluth is at 82% versus the 91. University of Minnesota Morris is 86%. And Crookston is at 74%. I can quickly give you the four-year and six-year graduation rates. In Duluth, the four-year graduation rate is 33%, and the six-year is 60%. On the Morris campus, the four-year rate is 51%, and the six-year is 67%. And on the Crookston campus, the four-year is 33%. And the six-year is 52%.
Representative Lee, said. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just say, if we are going to move ahead in this discussion, I know some of the campuses, Rochester is a small and new university. It has been a focal point of them to have this four-year graduation. They've been tracking the students very carefully on this. And so, you know, Rochester won't have its first graduating class until this year. But I think it will be interesting to see if the efforts that they have put forward are going to, you know, result. And I think they've had pretty high retention to date, and to see the graduation rates, and then perhaps if some of these efforts that the different universities are making that are working can be replicated, we might want to take a look at that. But it sounds like we're going to do that for another day. That'd be great.
Yeah, Representative, the Office of Higher Ed is coming in with that data, but I would encourage members, if you have a campus in or near your district that you visit it, that you ask for the data on campus and get a tour of the campus, both from the administration, the faculty, the students, and the other constituency groups, and do it separately so that there isn't one overriding influence in any of these discussions. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along with that, I would just ask for information about the readiness of the students and the it's important to be thinking about the completion, but if they're not coming in at the point of readiness and that's where you might start the problem. So to have that as part of the discussion, thank you.
That's not a question. You just want that for later. Okay. Proceed.
All right. Mr. Chair, members, the next six slides, we're going to talk through some of the components of the annual budget now at the university, what we plan for, and then also about process, so a little bit about how we put that budget together, and that's over the next six slides. So on this slide, this is to point out we have over a $3 billion a year annual budget, all funds combined. We do incremental budgeting, so we look at a base plus minus for most units. And we really define the budget challenge every year by looking at a number of things. First of all, we do look at what's happening with the state appropriation. Is it going up? Is it going down? Do we know? What have we proposed for the year? And that obviously depends on the year we're in. Sometimes we know the next year's appropriation. Sometimes we don't. The second thing we do is look at, as I mentioned earlier, which costs are going up that we know about, that you would consider to be more fixed costs, so things like debt service or utilities or fringe benefits. And where do we have discretion in the budget, and what do we want to do with that discretion? So if we were going to give our employees a pay increase, compensation is our single largest expenditure at the university. So what would the impact of that pay increase be, and how much is that? Does the president want to make strategic investments as part of the annual budget? And the answer is always yes. And how much would that be? Do we need to invest in financial aid, more student aid for the students? Do we have safety or contractual issues that we have to address, and so forth? So we look at what's happening with the state money, what is happening with our costs, and then we turn to how we're going to solve that challenge. The combination of those things creates a budget challenge. And the two basic tools that we look at in addition to that are tuition, what are we going to do with tuition, and the internal reallocations that we're going to put on our units, our departments across the university. You can see on this slide 3 years of information on what that budget challenge has been. So during budget development every year, and this is at a total university level, we calculate our budget challenge, which consists of our known and our planned cost increases, and we identify the solutions in balancing the budget. So you will see for 10, 11, and 12, the challenge here is in categories, five summary categories we've listed. The reduction in the state appropriation in each of these 3 years is the first line, and that is, in our planning purposes, considered a challenge. That's a reduction in our current resources available to cover expenses. We have compensation in here, and again, the amount of a salary increase is different every year, and it also includes the cost of fringe benefit increases, so health care and so forth is in that compensation line. We have programmatic initiatives. These are the strategic investments that the president would like to make. We have facility costs, again, leases, debt service, utilities, those types of new building operations. And we have student aid. Those are the major categories. There are obviously many lines underneath each one of those, but the major categories that define our budget challenge. Then in the budget process, we solve that budget challenge in a variety of ways. The tuition increase you see there every year, and we'll talk more about that and what it has been in this time frame and even longer. We have operating cost reductions every year that are implemented on all of our units across all campuses. We have other revenue changes, other revenue meaning, and we'll go into this a little bit more coming up, but we have other sources of discretionary and restricted revenues that we can apply toward the budget. And then we have implemented wage freezes twice in these particular 3 years that pulled down that cost of compensation. As I mentioned, the compensation number is a salary and fringe cost increase. The wage freeze that you see here would be we decided not to provide a salary increase, but we still had fringe cost increases in those years. That's why the two numbers will not equal. Okay, so we still have cost increases for health care and so forth, even if we do not give a salary increase. Our wage freezes, and we can go into more detail on that if you like, but they are a real wage freeze. We do not give a merit increase or a step increase in those cases. We have not. Just a couple of points on this one. If you look in the solutions over these particular 3 years, the average percent of the solution that tuition represents has been 33%. It varied, obviously, 24, 44, 34, but the average is 33. The average on the operating cost reductions is 44%. And then other revenue is 10, and wage freezes was 13 across these 3 years.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one, I think, important takeaway that we would appreciate the committee understanding is that your state appropriation is obviously an important component of our budget challenge every year, whether it's going obviously up or down. But it isn't only what happens to the state appropriation that influences internal reallocations or, unfortunately, tuition increases on students, because we have costs that go beyond what the state is accustomed to providing the university through its state appropriation. We have, when the exchange rates in the world go up or modify, we have a very large increase in the cost of library materials, particularly printed, because a lot of it isn't printed in this country anymore. When, you know, these software systems and technology goes up, there's licensing agreements for all sorts of technology that we face just the minute you put a new software system in. Those costs go up, and those are not costs that we have brought to the state to pay for. We have a new enterprise system to put in. We're in the process of spending $83 million upgrading our HR and student system, and we will internally charge units and ask them to reallocate money to pay for that. So again, just one takeaway is our budget problems and challenges goes beyond just the challenge that's left by changes in our state appropriation.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably a question for Ms. Tonneson, looking at slide 13. Obviously, there's a huge interplay between your challenge and your solution, because however you define your challenge, it determines how much of a solution you need. And, you know, any limits that you might have on your solutions might determine how much of a challenge you can accept. And so the question is, how do you determine how much tuition you can raise? How do you know what limit, or is there a limit, or how do you determine what's affordable?
Ms. Tonneson or Mr. Fitzenreiter, who's going to answer?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, there's actually many components to that conversation, because we do look at, first of all, we look at undergraduate versus graduate differently. We look at resident versus non-resident differently. We also look at what the trend has been in tuition, what the students have been facing, what has been the demand, where do we fit within our comparison groups within the Big Ten and nationally in terms of tuition. We don't use tuition as a filler to fill the budget, so we don't set the increase to balance the budget. More often than not, we determine a tuition increase based on all those other factors I mentioned. And then back into the reallocation that is necessary to balance the budget. So I don't know if that helps answer the question.
Mr. Chair, it does help. I mean, I guess your statement is that you start by identifying what you have available, and then you decide how to allocate. I mean, in your terms, you decide how much solution you have, and then you figure out what your challenge is.
Ms. Tonneson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, in part, it's really kind of interactive. I would say on tuition, that is true. That is not necessarily true on the reallocation portion of the budget or looking to other revenue sources. So it's a combination of both looking at the costs and what we know we have to face and what we'd like to plan for to spend, and the revenues that are available or that we might want to reallocate to make those investments possible. So it's a combination.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Tonneson, and one of the things you identified in determining how much tuition increase would be reasonable is looking at comparable institutions. And and you can correct me if this is an error, but it's my general observation or impression that tuition has been going up everywhere by very high amounts, regardless of whether they get a biennial an appropriation from the state of Minnesota, that all of higher education is experiencing significant tuition increases. And obviously, if everybody's looking around at everybody else and saying, well, we're all going up, so let's all go up. There's going to be an inflationary factor in tuition. I guess the question is, why is tuition going up everywhere? The story you're telling is a story that's individual to the University of Minnesota, but the end result is tuition's going up everywhere. So what's driving it?
Ms. Donaldson. Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if the question is what's driving tuition up, I'm going to get into the weeds a little bit here, but I mean, clearly, having watched in particular the last decade, although if Peter Zetterberg, who passed away suddenly 2 years ago, always told me that if you look back, and it's not an excuse, I'm not making an excuse that it's the right thing, but that tuition in this country has doubled every 10 years since the 50s. And the question is, what's causing that? What's driving that behavior? So I don't think it's fair to put the entire responsibility on the state. We have had increases in our state appropriation, and we have still increased tuition. It's a phenomenon that's occurring in the country. We don't, like my colleague said, we don't set the tuition number and then decide that's what we need or should get. It's more of an iterative back and forth throughout the process. I think President Kaler clearly recognizes, it's why we debated greatly, and I know we're not here to talk about our binding request, but we certainly debated greatly inside the university, and the president felt very strongly that he wanted to put a stop to tuition. He wanted to have the tuition conversation with the legislature, so our request is a specific ask. First time in my recollection that any university here in Minnesota has put that issue flat, square in the middle of the table about freezing tuition in exchange for an increase in state appropriation. I think we could have some more experts here from around the country that would be probably better at it than me to describe what interplay is going on in higher ed over the last more than 60 years that's driving tuition up. I think it's a lot of factors. Cost is one of them, declining state money is another. But I wouldn't put the blame on any particular reason. It's a combination of lots of things that are going on. Society's view that it's a private good has, I think, driven it. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop there, and we can certainly have probably hours of conversation about this one.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler,
Fitzenreiter, it just seems to me that if you want to talk about tuition, that's kind of the million-dollar question, or the, I don't know, billion, trillion-dollar question, maybe? I'm not sure. you've been at it for 20 years, I guess. Since that's two decades, that means tuition has quadrupled in your time, on average, if those trends continue. And I just wonder if you have an opinion about what the drivers are.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, clearly the drivers, and I'll just be honest, that I've seen the drivers. The drivers are certainly the cost side. The driver is also not as robust growth, and we'll show you some pictures but of state appropriation. But I think, to be honest, it's been there because higher ed could increase tuition. That it was there to raise. It was money that universities needed, and they raised it.
Mr. Fitzgerald, I have two more members, but since you brought it up, did the University of Minnesota ever raise tuition higher than it needed it in order to bank because of what's been going on with the state? It's difficult to see in what you're presenting here that how do we know the University of Minnesota didn't arbitrarily increase tuition more than it needed it? How would we know that as legislators?
Mr. Fitzenreiter. What we make sure happens in the budget process is that our challenge that we ultimately face is balance against the revenues we raise. So we haven't raised or attempted to raise more revenue in any year that I've been involved at the university for the last 20 years. We've had a budget challenge and we've had a solution. This has been the framework that we've had since I came to the university. So, and this framework every year is presented to the Board of Regents. So there isn't a case where the solution here would be more than the challenge. Now, I think your next question probably is, well, or some other committee members are thinking, well, did you goose the challenge, mm-hmm. right, to raise more tuition? And, you know, that's back to what, you know, did we raise tuition because the president wanted to invest more or he wanted to provide a compensation increase? The answer to that is yes. But I don't think we did it with the idea of just banking tuition because we could. We raised it to spend it to meet a budget priority of the president of the university.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions, but just an initial comment on that. From the articles I've read, tuition is going up faster than energy costs or health care costs in this country. So it is escalating at an extremely high rate, and I think somehow we got to get a control of that. But anyway, that's just a general comment. My first question has to do with compensation. When I was on a school board the last couple of years, the state passed a law that school districts had to show their liability on retirement benefits, okay, future and current, I believe. And when that happened, it showed a huge disparity across the state of Minnesota on what districts had negotiated in terms of retirement benefits. And I noticed, I'm on Ed Finance, and I noticed some districts are actually bonding to cover their retirement benefits, okay, which I consider to be a very troubling trend if that's the way we're going to deal with shortfalls in retirement. Is the university and the Minsky system required to show on their balance sheet something similar? And I'd be interested in the future being able to see historical and comparative data on those retirement benefits, you know, with other universities. Also, how have they grown over the last decade or so?
Mr. Pitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on this one I can give you good news. The university has a very, very small liability in that area. It is recorded in our financial statements, and I will get to the specific number, but I believe it's probably less than $30 million. Other universities in this country, some in the Big Ten, have guaranteed, you know, I think of Michigan, a few others, have guaranteed health care benefits for life. That's not a program that the university has ever offered, and our liability is small.
Representative Grudin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The second question is under tuition. Some incidental information I've read about in the last few months. It seems like we're charging our foreign and outstate students tuition charge comparatively less than other universities, and our in-state resident students are actually paying a premium because of that. Again, I'm open to correction on that, but that's just incidental. And many of those foreign students, my understanding is, pay cash for tuition that come over here. And we're quite low in comparison to what other universities charge in similar situations. Is that correct understanding, or am I off on that?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you are correct that compared to, let's say, our Big Ten peers, our out-of-state tuition charge is lower than all of them, matter of fact. We strategically made that choice, I think in 2009, really with the intent of broadening our recruitment base for out-of-state students to become a more national university, but not at the cost of Minnesota students. So Vice Provost McMaster has continually set a goal of maintaining between 60 and 65% of the Twin Cities enrollment to be Minnesota residents. We are really trying to substitute out, to be honest with you, reciprocity students for a more national you look. With regard to international students, we are reviewing that tuition policy right now, and we'll very likely bring something forward that looks different to the Board of Regents this spring.
Representative Gerdingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norgan.
Mr. Chair, I have a question, but I want to follow on a little bit to what Representative Winkler was saying and follow along with that. And I guess I would be interested in whether there is a correlation, as we've watched tuition increases, with the appropriation of federal loans, the availability of federal loans and state grants. Because it seems to me we, with a philosophy that's way before my time, have set in motion the tuition increases because of the way we're subsidizing our students. If we keep giving the students grants and loans, tuition can go up. And I would say, and I know I'm alone probably on this committee with my opinion, but I think the state grants, the competition with our private colleges and the money being appropriated to follow the student and the majority of that, a lot of that grant money, if it's a majority, going into private colleges has also caused a competition that might be worth looking at as well with some of this. But we as a legislature and a society keep telling our students they all need to get a college degree. We set that as a bar, and then we keep raising the bar and subsidizing with amounts that are not like the old days where they used to almost get their college paid for free. If you were subsidizing someone, you're subsidizing them, they still have to take out loans, and we get in this system that we've seen. So I would just be interested, as you move ahead, if someone could look at a correlation between the increasing federal grant and state loan and rising tuition. The question I have is programmatic initiatives on your slide 13. Mm-hmm. The 27 million under the 26% increase under 2010-2011, and what that meant, why the initiatives, what was that money spent on, the increase?
Ms. Tonenson?
Mr. Chair, members, just clarification too. The 26% means it was 26% of the challenge. It didn't mean it was a growth of 26%. I just want to verify that. Okay. It's just 26% of the challenge that year.
But it looks like $10 million increase in spending.
Ms. Tonenson.
Right. Yes, Mr. Chair, members, that's correct in that particular category. And you're going to ask me a question I probably can't answer sitting here today. I don't remember. I doubt if you guys remember specifically what those are. It is actually, I can tell you, a list of many initiatives. These aren't, three, four initiatives at multi-million dollars. They're programmatic. They go to colleges and campuses all over and support units. And so it's a very long list. But I don't have that sitting here today. I'm sorry.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I would just say, I guess I'm interested in keeping an eye on this sort of spending, because that caused a bigger challenge on the other side for you to have to be faced with. So it looks like a lot of a significant increase in a one-year period of time at a time when the state is giving you less money. Sure. There are more initiatives. And what's the management like of that money that's doled out in those program initiatives? How's that money being managed? Are you, as a higher-level authority, making certain that that money is being managed well? You know, what kind of feedback do you get? So I would just be interested as we move ahead to keep an eye on that sort of thing.
Pitson Rider.
Chairman, members, a couple observations there. It was always, and I think President Brunitz even came here to the legislature and testified, he was always committed, even in the times in which the state budget appropriation was dropping, to still cutting budgets and reinvesting. So, but as we all know, tuition also goes up. When you look at this chart, you'll see down in the solution side, $44 million of operating reductions. So at the university, we both reduce, raise tuition, and invest. And that's what you're seeing in these charts. And we have as my colleague said, we do have a list behind every one of those investments, and we'll bring some of those to share with you.
And if I could follow up just real quickly, Mr. Chair, members, and some of the things that Fitz mentioned earlier are in there that you might not think of as programmatic initiatives, but things like the licensing agreements for our technology, our software, would be in that category. Some of the things, you know, you might not think about them as programmatic, but in this level of summarization, they would be included in there. So we might have $1 million increase 1 year in just that. So just to follow up.
And Mr. Chairman, just another observation. Mm-hmm. I think when you have HESO in here on their student debt report, you're going to see some interesting statistics. I don't want to steal their thunder, but between 2011 and 2009, borrowing by Minnesota students went up $200 million. Now, enrollment went up 8% as well during that time period, so some of that is enrollment-driven. But borrowing increased during that period, despite, in their report, we'll point it out, a 40% increase in grants and scholarships. And the fact that borrowing has increased between 2001 and 2011 at a rate faster than tuition and fees are going up. So there are a lot of things going on in the student borrowing. I can tell you at the University of Minnesota, you can't, and in Minsky and the Friends, you can't just look at the growth in tuition. You need to look at the cost of attendance, because that's what the student pays. And at the University of Minnesota, we'd be happy to share this too. We've worked hard to keep that other half of the cost of attendance, which really is the room and board costs, down for students. So we are seeing big increases in tuition, but we're paying attention to the total cost of attendance as well, which I think is also important for students. We will, in our case, later in the presentation, show you how much institutional aid that we're putting in. Again, a reason why you need to think about the cost of attendance. You can't just think about sticker, and you need to understand how much money we're putting into financial aid for students, even though the tuition rates are increasing.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, you're dating yourself by referring to HESO. The chair knows that because he eliminated that agency, and then it morphed itself back into the Office of Higher Education. In fact, I think the chair eliminated it three times, and it still morphed back. I have one last question on this slide, and let's see if you can answer this one. These three budgets, would you say the three budgets would be characterized as a top-down or campus-up approach? Would you know?
Mr. Chairman, actually, we'll get into that shortly as to how
the process.
This is the overall framework and how we go about unit by unit here. We'll get to that shortly. One other slide before we get there.
Quick slides on that reallocation portion of the challenge in terms of solution. One specifically related here to health plan savings, because we have done a lot in the last number of years with our health plans to try to reduce the agency's the university's expense. And you can see here a list of things that we have implemented and the cumulative savings through FY12 of each one of those as projected by our Office of Human Resources. Some of these savings are obviously cost avoidance, because they happened in 1 year and through FY12 would have cost us these dollar amounts, but we were able to avoid those costs. So we have the two largest things we have done really in terms of a cost savings effort in this area. It has to do with the co-pays and the costs of prescription drugs, in terms of changing both trying to get people to use generics, which lowers our overall cost that we pay, and also by changing the amount that employees pay for their drugs, towards their drugs. So that was a large change on a couple lines here. The second largest thing we have done in terms of a cost savings has to do with the contribution amounts for our medical and dental expenses by employees. And those health care is the largest, single largest expense in the fringe benefit area, and we have over time moved what the employee pays to the levels you see here. So for family, when you're looking down near the bottom, our family medical coverage for the base low-cost plan, families now pay 19.5%. If you are a single employee, you're paying 13.5% of your cost. Again, that's for the lowest cost plan. If you choose to buy up, you pay more. But that was a major change. We've also changed a lot of our co-pays and deductibles over time, increasing them for employees to lower the university's expense. So that's one major area of change we've implemented in the cost side. other cost reductions now in the 2006 to 2012 time frame, which a lot of our data here today is reflected. We, over that time period, we have internally reallocated $228 million. $176.5 actually occurred on the previous slide, that two slides ago, between 10, 11, and 12. But if you expand to 2006 to 12, we've reallocated $228 million. Through our process, which we'll explain here in the next couple slides, we have not done this across the board. We are strategic in how we implement these reductions by unit and by campus. Every major unit has been impacted. There really has been no one who has escaped cuts. We have tried very hard to reduce administrative processes and costs and move any reallocation back into academic programming. We also exempted student aid from cuts in this area. And so these are examples, what you see down on the bottom. We have provided the chair with a letter that was actually written in March of 2012 that explained reallocations and was sent to Representative Nornes. We provided that to the chair. But these are examples here of things that we have implemented. And you can see by college it's going to vary. So things like we have when a faculty position becomes vacant due to retirement or leaving the university, there, many of those have not been refilled in this time frame. So you see some impacts there in Vet Med, TENS, College of Food, Agricultural and Natural Resource Sciences, 11, Liberal Arts, 60, UMD, 20, and so forth. That has occurred throughout all of our colleges and campuses. We also academically have increased curricular efficiencies. This is where you're going to see larger class sizes, more adjunct instructors. When we lose faculty positions, they will hire adjunct instructors, which are less expensive. We've had reductions in projects and programs throughout the colleges. We have had some impact in some areas on retaining faculty members. They are recruited nationally in many of these areas, and we have lost a number of them to other institutions who are willing to pay more. We have implemented early retirement incentive options in 03, in 08, and in 11 to try to get people to retire. We have laid off staff throughout the institution. There are a couple examples there. Reduce spending on travel, equipment, supplies, all of those types of things, and really implemented a lot of new things in terms of facility management and this new team cleaning model they've implemented, energy conservation, and so forth. We've really done a lot across all units in the last 6 to 8 years in terms of reallocation. Moving on then to
Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Tonneson, where does that $228 million of cost reduction, where does that get reallocated
Ms. to then?
Mr. Chair, members, it isn't a, when you look at that challenge slide that showed the, you know, the different cost challenges with the solutions, we don't tie one-to-one, so I can't tell you that we cut this in order to fund that. It's a total. But all of these reductions were done to balance the budget, so some to pay, to be reallocated to pay for investment in other areas, some to cover the reduction in reduction in the state appropriation, some to pay for compensation increases, so on and so forth.
Representative Johns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could you provide us that information so we could see where that went?
Ms. Tonneson.
Mr. Chair, members, again, we can't do a one-to-one. I can't tell you that we reallocated $20 million this year and this is exactly where it went, because that isn't, it's in total. So I can't there, I can't tie this reallocation to this investment. Is that what you're looking for?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's sort of what I'm looking for. I'm looking for something more easily identifiable, so I could see specifically where that 228 went.
Ms. Donaldson.
Mr. Chair, members, well, I'll have to think about a good way to explain that. Maybe when we get to a unit level, it will make a little bit more more sense. When we talk about one college, for example, and how we look at their costs and the solutions to balance the budget there, because we actually do the budget discussions at a unit level and then roll it all up. to the university level. So maybe when we get there, it'll make a little more sense, or we can think about how best to answer that question.
Ms. Townend said, would one of the campuses be able to give Representative Johnson an answer? For instance, Morris, Crookston, Duluth, Rochester? Certainly they should be able to tell us, given the scope of that amount of money, how that was reallocated within their campus or program. Assuming you can break it down that way, but I would assume you could.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think there's, again, a couple of questions going on. Mr. Chairman, I think your question was, do you want to see all the examples of the $228 million of reallocation over this time period? There are thousands of individual decisions and cuts that occurred to get that summed up number. If you want to
rather than displaying a blizzard, couldn't you just go to a campus and say, I would like to see how you reallocated over that period of time? And certainly a campus at that level must have some examples that would answer Representative Johnson. I mean, if you use it in the aggregate, it's blinding. But if we break it down and say at the campus level, somebody made a decision somewhere and saved money and put it someplace.
Mr. Chairman,
should be able to be answered.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the answer to your question is yes, but I believe the representative was asking a slightly different question, that he was saying if you reallocated or cut a vacant faculty position and reallocated that money, what did that money get reallocated to, I think was your question.
Representative Johnson.
I'll go with the chair on this point.
Okay. Mr. Chairman will get an example by a college.
Well, and if you had one on each campus, it would even be more interesting for us.
Sure.
Yeah.
So instead of billions of snowflakes, let's just try for four.
Sure.
Okay.
And speaking of the billions of snowflakes, Mr. Chair and members, these are, on this slide, the units. When we have been talking about major or primary budget units, this is the level of the university that we do budgeting at in terms of the annual budget process and approval by the Board of Regents. So we have on the Twin Cities campus each of the major academic units, the colleges, and other academic units on the left, the coordinate campuses on the left, and then each of our major support units are listed on the right. And this is the level that we meet with every year. In fact, we can move to the next slide, which is a little bit more about...
Representative Winkler has a question.
Sure.
It might be on this one.
Sorry.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It's actually back on slide 15, the examples of the operating cost reductions. Mm-hmm. I kind of break these down into reductions that affect the quality of education and reductions that are just things that really don't impact students at all or research. For example, the first one, employee health care benefits restructuring. Students don't care. Doesn't affect teaching, doesn't affect research. Facility cost reductions through energy conservation, cleaning models. Students don't care. But some of the things that, you know, if you're not filling faculty positions and students can't get classes they need, that could affect the quality of education. Curricular efficiencies, such as larger class size, more adjunct professors, reduced number of electives, certainly affect students. Reductions in interdisciplinary projects, graduate programs, depending on what that is, that could certainly affect students. Reduced retention capacity presumably degrades the quality of the faculty. And so if you kind of, I look at those four items as being really primary ways. When you call something an operating cost reduction, it sounds a bit like it's an administrative efficiency, but it looks to me more like we're reducing some quality of student or research experience in order to fund other kinds of new initiatives. So I guess the question, so these cost reductions, I mean, can you break it down into what you would consider sort of administrative efficiency? So these cost reductions, I mean, can you break it down into what you would consider sort of administrative efficiencies, back office consolidation, things that, you know, don't really help students and don't promote research versus things that actually affect the quality of the program you're offering for the dollars that you're charging?
Ms. Tonnison?
Mr. Chair, members, we can categorize the reallocation in different ways like that. A lot of these examples came from direct response from our deans and chancellors in terms of the impact the reductions have had on their operations, where they have had to make tough choices. And I think it is fair to say that we can't reduce our costs this much without impacting students. And again, it isn't all for new investment. Some of it was to replace state funding or to pay for compensation and so forth. So we can categorize them in different ways. Whether we can quantify that over this time period, I'm not sure. We'd have to take a look because these, again, these are responses from the units in terms of the impact on their operations from a programmatic view of the world. So we can attempt.
Well, Ms. Tonneson, the University of Minnesota has apparently no problem in the course of any legislative session showing us how successful it's been in any given area. Mm-hmm. Where it appears to have great difficulty is showing us where it's had to make tough choices and illustrate it, unless it's in such a big picture it's hard to comprehend. So this is the session where I'm going to forego the rah-rah for a while, and I'd like to look at the, oh my, gee, this hurts, and how it hurt at that same level. If you've had very successful programs, and you've had, they've been in here, and we've wondered at brains and Tupperware and other things, now I want to know exactly where there has been a problem and how you've managed it with this type of reallocation or reduction. Could you illustrate any of those?
Mr.
Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members, you know, when you make a presentation like this, you tend to summarize things up to a high level. If you are interested in the snowflakes, and you mentioned a minute ago you weren't, but we'd be happy to provide much more detail if that's what you would like. We can do that. It's always just a balance of how much information you want.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, and again, I'm going to repeat, you've never had a problem showing us the glittering, marvelous snowflakes that the U's produced. It's the dirty ones that, you know, are full of salt and sand now that are being brushed away. And those are the ones I'd like to take a look at and see what exactly was brushed away. What was hurt by this? I assume something must have been. What was it? I know faculty have come up and told us privately they've had to make tough choices in their departments. They've either eliminated a course or a program. They've had to more than double, in some cases, was my understanding, students in certain classes in order to make sure their program worked. Any of those would be acceptable. And that's why we're going through this. So, all right. Representative Winkler, were you done? I cut in on you.
It's okay, Mr. Chair.
That's right.
Okay, slide 17, which is about the process. If we could talk about what we do on an annual basis, we have a budget committee that has been delegated by the president to implement the budget process. And that budget committee is made up of the provost, vice president for health sciences, vice president for research, the CFO, and myself. And we meet every year with every one of the units that was on the previous slide and go through a conversation that is really very much like the framework conversation, but at a unit level. And that comes about by an internal process where we give a set of budget instructions, much like the state does to its agencies. We give budget instructions to each one of our units, and they, in turn, have a budget process within their unit, working with their departments on balancing and proposing their budget and trying to balance their budget. And so if you're the College of Liberal Arts or you are the Crookston campus, they have an internal budget process where they involve people from the campus as much as possible, and it will vary by unit in terms of how that works. They involve people in putting together their budget proposals in line with our instructions, and then they bring forward that budget proposal, that budget submittal, every year. And the sum result of that, and we'll talk more about it on the next slide in terms of what we discuss, we end up with a balanced budget for the university that then gets presented to the board for approval. But through that process, what we talk about is really the same major issues we talk about at the university level. So in the fall, we meet with every one of our support units that were on the right side of that previous chart, and we talk about what are their compensation costs, how much is it going to cost them to pay their people given the salary plan that the president has put forward. We talk about any strategic academic priorities that they would like to pursue. We talk about any operating cost or infrastructure kind of expenses or challenges that they have. The solutions on the support unit side that we talk about are internal reallocation. Again, we can ask them to take money from a lower priority and give it to a higher priority item that they are proposing. A few of the support units have earned revenue. So, for example, we have a police department that has fines. There are very few of these, but occasionally we have that opportunity. We look at what's happening with that fine revenue. It happens to be going down, by the way. But whatever's happening with it, that could potentially be a solution. And our final solution, if we're not going to reallocate to pay for something that we that the president would like to do, and we don't have any earned revenues, we increase their allocation for that particular support unit. And I'll talk more about where that money comes from in a minute. But then we move on to the academic units, which is every one of the Twin Cities colleges and each campus, each coordinate campus. And we have the same kind of conversation with them in the winter and spring. And at that level, so we meet with the Morris campus, for example, and we talk about what are their compensation costs, what are their strategic academic priorities they would like to pursue, what other financial issues do they have, and we have the same solutions but more on the academic unit side, because we will also talk about internal reallocation there, and again, moving funds from lower priority to higher priority items. We talk about earned revenue at the academic unit level because this will include tuition. And as you will see when we talk about our budget model, the tuition that is generated at Morris stays at Morris. So if there is an increase there, what costs will that increase be applied to? We have other sources of revenue. They have gifts. They have endowment earnings. They have indirect cost recovery revenue. They have other sources of revenue that might be growing, that might contribute to the solution and help pay for the costs that we've identified. If we get a state appropriation increase in the years that that happens, we give that to the academic units, which you will see when we talk about the budget model. And again, we can move appropriation between academic units, so we can take from one and give to another. Although, as I mentioned earlier, this is an incremental process. It is a base plus minus process at this level as well, so that we start with their recurring base and talk about increases and decreases for all of these various purposes. And they bring that forward annually. We talk about it annually. We go back and that budget committee makes a recommendation to the president about how much state appropriation will go to each unit and how much their tuition should increase and so forth. That's done at a unit level, and then we add it all up, making sure it all balances when we bring it to the board. That's real quick for so a
Ms. Tonneson, this unit level, mm-hmm. it's a campus then like Crookston,
correct.
And we would be able to see a proposed budget from Crookston and then what they actually got in comparison to the proposed budget.
Mr. Chairman, members, that is correct.
All right. Representative Grunay.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. This is just a question for the testifiers. As far as the regents, you know, are they more of a figurehead, or do they have actual authority to hire, fire, you know, change courses? My understanding is they're more of a figurehead than being able to implement actual consequences, like removal of a professor for whatever reason. Who has that authority if they don't?
Thank you. Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I noticed Chair Cohen is in the audience. The Board of Regents has an entire set of policies around academic programs, financial, budget. They approve a variety of things. I would not at all call them a figurehead. I think that's an absolute misnomer.
Okay.
They take an enormous amount of the leadership time of the university based on their meeting schedule. It is a robust and aggressive meeting schedule. They get a budget document from us recommended by the president each June that's well approaches 90 pages long of information and things they need to approve. So I think it's pretty robust. And they spend a lot of time dissecting that budget.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Just a quick follow-up. Do they have the authority to hire and terminate employees?
Mr. Chairman, they do reserve certain authority over certain, I don't know it well enough, certain high-level employees at the University of Minnesota in particular. We could certainly come back and give you a synopsis of their authorities and responsibilities.
Representative Gruenhagen, you might want to wait until House Research gives us an overview. However, past performance of the regions is in the document that I think all the members got, and you can look over that. Maybe recent past performance might be even of more interest to you. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to follow up on Representative Gruenhagen's question, Mr. Fitzenreiter. It says the Board of Regents reviews and approves the annual budget. How often do the regents send it back?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have not seen the Board of Regents send the budget back. The budget is presented for review in early June. Every other year we have to wait until sometime after the third Monday in May following the first Saturday when folks typically adjourn to know what our state appropriation is. We then submit the budget to the board in June. They review it in early June. There's a public hearing on the budget that they board members sit for, and then it is approved later, typically sometimes around the 28th, 29th of June. I have seen slight modifications between the review and approval period based on feedback from regents, but it isn't a process in which it's sent back. It's not a legislative kind of process. It's a collaborative discussion, review, and approval process.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, I'm just looking at your slide, and this is number 17, and it looks like sort of the budget is set, and then it's sent over for approval, and so your slide doesn't indicate a lot of back and forth, but maybe that is what takes place during that several weeks in June. Do the regents get involved as this budget proposal is being prepared? Are they setting policy or identifying a direction before you send them a budget to be approved?
Mr. Fitzgerald. Chairman, members of the committee, they have a variety of opportunities throughout the year with respect to the budget. They approve, for example, the biennial request we mentioned earlier, and the biennial request is part of that overall framework. We do a long-range financial plan with the Board of Regents that is updated actually twice a year. That provides feedback into the annual operating budget. And in addition to that, there are topics that relate to the budget that are in front of the board at different stages throughout the calendar year and fiscal year that they ultimately will find their way into the annual operating budget that gets presented to them. Again, this slide probably, you're right, truncates their involvement some. It just simply pointed out that the board has a review and then approval. A two-step process is what was meant to be communicated here, not exactly how the feedback flows between the board and the president.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, could you just explain a little bit more about what this financial plan is that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Board of Regents for, it seems like, quite a few years has pressed the administration to do a long-term financial framework. I'll be candid. President Bernanke was a reluctant partner to that effort. I think he felt that there were just so many unknowns that a long-range framework was not worth doing. My office built a long-range financial model despite that, and the Board of Regents insisted on becoming engaged in that discussion, and we now do that with them twice a year. And that's really been a more recent, last couple of years phenomena. We had built the model probably half a dozen years ago.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, would an analogy be to something like a comprehensive plan and a zoning map? Does the budget that's proposed have to fit within the confines of the financial plan? And is that more of a high-level policy document, or is that more of sort of a just sort of a generalized idea of kind of where you want to go, and then the budget is the real document that decides, that actually takes the steps of? I mean, obviously, that's the specific plan that implements whatever decision you make. The question is there a sense that the budget has to fit within the framework of the financial plan, or is the budget pretty much just stand on its own and it doesn't have to be guided by these other policies?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think the alignment between those two documents is quite strong, and assumptions, and it's a fairly sophisticated model that I will also talk about in terms of how we use that model for debt capacity forecasting. But it is a very sophisticated revenue and expenditure model for the university and the out year. We project expenditures and we project revenues and we play what if scenarios with that document, and it does align with the annual budget, I think, quite well.
Members, we're out of time, but we're going to pick it up exactly here. Representative Poppy is first. Representative Johnson, you're next on Wednesday. And if anyone else has any further questions, please save this so we don't have to reproduce this document. And thank you very much, and we'll see you on Wednesday. Meeting is adjourned.